Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest for the second hour will be Jonathan Gray, if she's good enough to stay with us. And basically, because Jonathan was explaining all the efforts were made to by the Jewish rabbis, certainly the members of the Pharisees, to undermine the belief in Christianity, because this was challenging their authority and their ability to control the Jewish people. And unfortunately, there is certainly a tendency within religious organizations to want to be controlling the minds of the people. So Jonathan is simply giving us the background of many of the things that were done to distort the history of that time, removing large segments from history and so much of what we read today in our textbooks, and certainly as we're told by our experts. It just is not true. So you pick up the story of what's happening here. What are we, something, first century A.D.?
Yeah, so we're talking here about the first century into the second century A.D. And we have here the Rabbi Akivah, who's known as the father of the Mishnah, around about in the 130s, just 30 years into the new century. Cutting out 160 years of Persian history, so the 490-year prophecy of messianic prophecy of Daniel would bypass Jesus Christ and stretch into the second century. And then a few years later, around AD 40, his accomplice, Rabbi Yose ben Halafta, codified this mutilated Jewish chronology into a book which is used widely today in the Jewish community. It's called the Book of the Order of the World, or Seder Olam Rabbah. Now, this false history, in true Persian history, there were 10 kings ruling. These kings ruled from 538 down to 331, when Alexander the Great defeated Persia and ended the empire. So we've got 140 years of Persian history there, and 10 kings. The falsified history cuts out 5 of the kings, and cuts down the 484 years of Persian history down to 24 years. Absolutely incredible. Slices out 160 years of history. Would you believe, this fake history is now used today worldwide by mainstream modern Jewry, an officially accepted fake. Now, it might be asked why cuts were made in the Persian period rather than in the Greek Seleucid area that followed that. Well, the answer is that Akivah and Yose ben Halafta couldn't make any cuts from the Greek period because the chronology of that period was still in use. It was still too close to their own day, and people would see through it. It was firmly fixed among the Jews, as well understood, it was too well known. So the best these poor men could do to pull off their deception was to go back to the earlier period, the Persian Empire period. And, of course, since the prophecy of Daniel 9 dealt with a decree that was issued by a Persian monarch to restore and build Jerusalem, this was the empire that preceded the Greeks. This left only this Persian Empire of history for them to exploit. Well, we might say, thank you, honest teachers, but we found you out. It's important to bear in mind that Josephus, their own historian, disagrees with them about the length of the Persian history. So any argument that maybe Josephus had done it is absolutely hollow. Now, the logical question that I guess anyone's going to ask is, do any of today's Jewish scholars know about this deliberate date fiddling? Well, yes, they do. Most certainly they do. The Encyclopedia Judaica has this to say, and I'll quote it, about Rabbi Yose's compression of the Persian period. Listen to this. I've got this encyclopedia right in front of me. It says the most significant confusion in Rabbi Yose's calculation is the compression of the Persian period. From the rebuilding of the temple by Zerubbabel in 516 BC.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Jonathan is simply quoting from the Jewish Encyclopedia, and certainly modern-day Jewish scholars have analyzed, of course, what was done back there in the first century to alter the history of that era. Why? Because, of course, they had to discredit Christianity even then, and so they simply removed about 100, 150 years of time period, because, you see, the prophecies of Daniel were very exact, and from the time that Cyrus was going to give the order for the rebuilding of the temple was to be exactly so many years and so many days, and that would be the time then when the Messiah would come. Well, I mean, certainly, how could you have a prophecy that would be accurate down to the very day? And so they couldn't allow that to stand, and so they just had to remove large periods of history so that they could say, see, it's not true at all, just as in rabbinical schools, I've been told, even today. When they're studying the book of Isaiah, they go from Isaiah 52 to Isaiah 54. Why? Because if you read Isaiah 53, you'll realize that Isaiah was talking about Jesus Christ, the most amazing, really what amazing prophecies. But certainly the removal of the time period was meant to discredit the writings of Daniel. So pick the story up there. What does it say in the modern Jewish encyclopedia?
Oh, Dr. Stan, this is what it says. Quote, the most significant confusion in Rabbi Yossi's calculation is the compression of the Persian period. From the rebuilding of the temple by Zerubbabel in 516 BC to the conquest of Persia by Alexander, compressing it to no more than 34 years. Well, there's an admission by the most respected authority in among the Jewish people today. And quite a number of Jewish scholars are aware of this problem. And some, such as Rabbi Simon Schwab, have tried to justify this chronological cover-up by stating something which I can hardly believe that he'd even bothered that he would dare write. He admits here, and I'm quoting him, that there was purposely eliminated and suppressed all records and other material pertaining to this change of removing years. And he says it was purposely eliminated and it was suppressed and all records pertaining to it. Now, there's a frank admission that this was a purposeful suppression of the truth. Okay, now, how does he justify this chronological sleight of hand?
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with all of our other stations here. Well, this is Dr. Stan Jonathan, simply reading some of the Jewish historians who try to justify this sleight of hand of just changing history so that they could disprove Daniel's prophecies. Because Daniel's prophecies, you know, written certainly somewhere 550 B.C., somewhere in that area, basically give you the exact number of days between when they declare, the emperor of Persia declares the temple of Jerusalem will be rebuilt, and the coming of the Messiah. So basically, if that you accept that's true, then of course Jesus is the Messiah. You discredit that by rewriting history and taking out large segments of time. How then do they justify doing that?
It's very, very interesting. I'm going to quote Schwab right now, and this is what he says. If so, what might have been their compelling reason for so an unusual procedure as cutting out so many years of time? My answer is this. Nothing short of a divine command could have prompted saintly men of truth to leave out completely from our annals a period of over 160 years and to correct all data and to correct all historical tables in such a fashion that the subsequent chronological gap could escape being noticed by countless generations known to a few initiates only who were duty-bound to keep the secret to themselves. So now what's this man saying? A divine command to cover up and deceive the Jewish people about their own history and that of the world? Well, I think perhaps their own prophet Amos puts his finger on the real problem. Amos 2:4, their lies have also led them astray, those after which their fathers walked. So what's the reason for this hoax? Well, you mentioned it, Dr. Stan. according to a number of Jewish scholars, including Schwab, but this their explanation is God directed the second century sages to falsify the data so as to confuse anyone trying to use the prophecies of Daniel to predict the time of Messiah. Okay, now here we've got the issue. God gave the prophecy to Daniel so that everyone would know when to expect the Messiah, and then God tried to cover up what he had revealed so people would not know?
Well, you know, I think that the important thing is to understand that there really are these two nominal gods. I mean, there's the God of the Bible, and then, of course, there's some people who look upon Lucifer as God. Certainly we do not, or if we refer to him in that way, it's with a small g. But we are really, of course, involved in a battle between good and evil. And there really are people today who worship the other God. And until you understand that, until you understand the Gnostic faith, nothing going on today makes sense. But if you read the writings of the Masons, you read them carefully, you'll find out that Masonry is a Gnostic faith. Rosicrucianism is a Gnostic faith. Theosophy is a Gnostic faith. And the Gnostics were, of course, there at this time in history, there in the first and second century. And they believed God was giving them direction. But I believe, of course, it was not the God of the Bible. Would you concur or disagree with that?
Totally. I agree with what you've just said. Absolutely.
You go right ahead, because, of course, you're much more of a scholar than I am. Remember, I'm simply a recycled orthopedist, but go right ahead.
Oh, Doctor, the Lord gives us all a different work to do, and I would need to come to you for many things that would leave me frazzled, and the Lord's given those to you.
Amen.
But we all work together for his kingdom.
Amen to that. Well, you go right ahead.
Well, here we have. They ripped out more than 160 years of real time from Persian chronology and just threw it away. Now, what do they hope to achieve? There were two things they wanted to accomplish in this. The first was to derail the evidence which Christians had successfully argued since the resurrection of Christ that Daniel's 490-year prophecy was fulfilled by him. The second thing they wanted to achieve was to extend Daniel's 490 years into their own day. And by doing this, they could whip up support for a different messianic figure who might revolt against the Roman occupation. And this was achieved by a man called Bar Kochba and the revolt of 132 to 135. Now, if we ever need evidence that Daniel's messianic prophecy was understood by the Jews of the first and second centuries, we don't have to look any further than this cover-up in the Seder Alone book. And its abbreviated chronology firstly deflected attention away from Yeshua's fulfillment of Daniel 9, and secondly, it facilitated Rabbi Akiva's attempt to support Simon Bar Kochba as the fulfillment of the prophecy. And it was taught that Bar Kochba would overthrow Roman rule, then rebuild the temple. Now, what was the result of this misidentification of Messiah? It was very, very tragic for the poor Jewish people. What happened was it led all Judea being laid waste by the Romans and by Jews being forbidden to live within 10 miles of Jerusalem. And as if that was not enough to add insult to injury, all Jews throughout the empire were required to pay a head tax to support a new pagan temple in, of all places, Jerusalem. And what astonishes me so much is that Jewish historians today still consider Bar Kochba as their most important messianic figure, to quote them. Well, by the 16th century, some Jewish scholars were starting to challenge this Seder Alone book. There was a rabbi by the name of Rossi de Rossi, and in his work, Enlightenment of the Eyes, he demonstrated that the year count was severely flawed. And although his conclusions were irrefutably correct, the revelation was hotly resisted by his fellow rabbis. and some of them tried to appeal to Rabbi Joseph Caro, who had written a famous book, urging him to ban Rabbi de Rossi's book. And Caro did actually impose an order to burn de Rossi's book, but he died before it could be implemented. And so the alteration to Persian Jewish history still remains in use. And yet, wherever you go in the world, no secular historian or no Persian or Christian scholars anywhere in the world accept the compressed version of history. They know that it's a fake. And many Jewish scholars are now also starting to dispute it. But when you discuss the Jewish date of the world, the source that's used is this very same book, the Seder Olam. In fact, that's the source where we get our counting of the year 2011. That's this year being the year 5771, year of the world. Now, when you compare the Hebrew Bible with the present Jewish calendar, now using the Bible, we calculate back from the King Solomon's reign, and that's a date fixed in history. We arrive at a date for Adam, which disagrees with today's fabricated Jewish calendar. So what we've got here is a contradiction between their calendar and their Bible. And although the Seder Olam is not a formal part of the Mishnah or the Talmud, it is a work of Talmudic authority today, and no Orthodox Jew would think of openly contradicting it, despite the realization that it is missing so many years. And you know, you have referred to this a couple of times today already, Dr. Stan, that we're in a great battle here. It's a cosmic battle between the forces of Satan and those of Jesus Christ. And I feel here that this is such a big hoax. It's got the breath of something bigger than just an ordinary human hoax. It's no ordinary hoax. I can see behind it the intense antagonism of the Legion of Lucifer. It's his long-running feud against the Prince of God. This is just one of his tricks that he's used men to foist upon other trusting people.
I think we can't really understand anything going on today unless we understand this. I mean, because so many things going on today just don't make sense if we really stop and think about them. And yet, of course, most people never stop and think, and they simply go along with it. They watch television. They watch the evening news. They watch the latest television. So the competition, say, for the best voice or the best dancer or something else. But they see unfolding events, and they just can't make a simple conclusion that, of course, we're seeing this cosmic battle being played out. And a beautiful example of that is the coming war in the Middle East. It's only a matter of time before we're in a major war in the Middle East. And the average American really doesn't see what's going on because he's too busy watching television. Go right ahead.
Yeah, it's so very, very sad. I have a brother-in-law down on this side of the world who has thought of nothing but education all his life. He excluded all spiritual values and put importance in education. He has so many degrees, I don't know how many. And then last year, he had a very serious health setback. And only this week, he said to us, I'm not enjoying my work anymore now. All I'm interested in is getting right with God because I realize there's nothing else worth living for.
And his sickness
has shaken the man up, and I just wish this, not wishing signals on everybody, I'm just wishing that a sudden wake up would occur to millions of people who are slumbering right now and thinking that they're all right.
Well, that's, of course, our hope is that maybe something we say or something one of our guests says will strike somebody's heart. Unfortunately, it seems that we only reach one person at a time. The other side reaches millions. But our job is to do our best. And certainly, people, I think, as things get worse, are going to be looking for answers. And when you lose your job and you lose your home and you lose your family and you lose your savings, maybe you're going to begin to, and maybe even part of your health, maybe you're going to realize that there's much more to life than simply living the good life. Maybe you're going to try to find what's important eternally. At least that's our hope and our prayer. We'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan Gray. Go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes, Dr. Spann, it's very interesting that this whole attempted cover-up of Daniel chapter 9 just will not die. I was noticing a report in history in Poland some time ago. In 1656, a dispute arose in Poland between some distinguished Jewish rabbis and some Christian students of the Book of Daniel. And the dispute concerned Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's 70 weeks, 490-year messianic prophecy. The students faced the rabbis and said, "Look here, this prophecy proves Yeshua to be the Messiah. It tells exactly when the Messiah was to suffer." Well, the rabbis were so hard-pressed by this argument, it was embarrassing. So they broke up the discussion. But then the rabbis held a meeting. And as a result, they pronounced a curse upon any Jew who should attempt to work out the chronology found in this prophecy. And this is their curse. "May his bones and his memory rot, who shall attempt to number the 70 weeks." I've come across a couple of curses. There's another one in the Talmud which mentions that the curse is based upon the fact that there are claims that the Messiah is in this prophecy. Well, of course there are claims. Daniel himself claimed it. And it's quite a frank admission. Well, that will continue, but I do believe that any atheist or any unbeliever, any skeptic who honestly approaches prophecy, Bible prophecy, will find that there is only one answer to the knowledge of events ahead, and that's an all-seeing God who gave his son to come down and predicted the date when he was coming. Now, at the same time that the cover-up was going on in the land of Israel, another cover-up began in Alexandria in Egypt, not too far away. Now, approximately the same time that the rabbis were mutilating that calendar, Ptolemy actually was a man, it was believed that he was a Roman who spoke Greek, but he lived in Alexandria. Ptolemy's star chart is famous, and Ptolemy's world map. Now, Ptolemy cut out. Did we mention this on a previous broadcast, Dr. Stanley?
No, we didn't.
We haven't talked about the gospel and the stars on this.
No.
Okay. Ptolemy actually got hold of a star chart that had been in use for 4,000 years and which identified the Messiah by name. That's a subject worth looking into sometime. And he cut out of the star chart and left a big blank on the star map where that constellation used to be. And that constellation was traced in recent years after Napoleon's soldiers went to Egypt and discovered the ancient star map painted onto the ceiling of a temple up the Nile Valley. And they recognized it and copied it, and it's in the Louvre at the moment in Paris. But this star chart actually not only revealed that there was a coming one, but the star, names of the stars, the names of the constellations spelled his name out just as it is in the Bible. And it seems that there was pressure in Alexandria to suppress the Christian gospel there, and so it was cut out.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Jonathan was just saying that there was certainly efforts. Very early on, some gentleman had actually taken the star chart and cut out part that had referred to Christ, and they reproduced the star chart, but they left out this one segment that really spoke and named Jesus coming. There's always been a conspiracy against God. I mean, and we talk about it today, but it existed 2,000 years ago. It has always existed. I mean, certainly, why do you think they took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools? I mean, do you think that this just happened by accident? There was no wall of separation between church and state. There is a conspiracy against God. There was a conspiracy against God 2,000 years ago. There's a conspiracy against God today. It's a common denominator behind everything going on. But you go right ahead.
Yes, it's a long-running battle. But we know who's on the winning. We know who's going to win. Just to recap a little bit, we remember that the Creator promised to send a rescuer, but Satan and his group came up with a stand-in personator, and that was to blind people from accepting the real thing. And this counterfeit Christ system wore many masks, but it was summed up in the name paganism or pagan mysteries. Now, eventually Jesus came. He broke into Satan's territory, and the hijacker of our planet, Satan himself, tried to overpower him, but Jesus beat him. He beat him in the wilderness when Satan offered to give him the kingdoms of the world. Just bow down to me and recognize that I've got this planet, and I'll give you all the kingdoms. And he failed to tempt him. And then we have Jesus living a blameless life, showing us how to successfully withstand Satan's tricks. And then he offered himself up as a sacrifice for everyone's wrong. Then, having fulfilled that purpose, he cracked the power of death and told his followers to go and let the world know what had happened. Wonderful message. Well, Satan's bid to sabotage Jesus Christ's entry into earth had failed. And, of course, he was furious. And so, immediately, there was planned an extermination campaign against Jesus' followers. It's interesting that the book of Revelation refers to this when it, I think it's Revelation chapter 12, it says when he saw that the woman's child had gone back to heaven, ascended to God and his throne, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man child. And in scripture, a woman is a symbol of a church. So the church, the bride of Christ, was persecuted. And if someone wants to get at you and they can't reach you physically, what's the best way they can get at you? It's by attacking somebody that you love, isn't it?
Right.
And so an attack came upon the ones that Jesus loved, who were here on earth, who had accepted him. And there were two centers of the attack. One was in Alexandria, which was the center of pagan philosophy, and the other was the headquarters of the empire. The two attacks were launched primarily from these two centers, the headquarters of the empire being the city of Rome. Let's just look at the Alexandrian attack first. First they tried to exterminate the followers. They hunted them down, they tortured them, they murdered them, but the numbers continued to explode, and so they plotted a different approach, and that was to set up the Alexandrian cult, which had one purpose only, and that was to infiltrate the Christian group and to tamper with the Gospels and make them more compatible with paganism so that Christianity would have no power over pagans, over the pagan religion. And the cult's allies in Rome were a great help too. Later on, an emperor would ascend the throne whose aims were similar, and his motive was more political, though, to amalgamate the two strong religions, Christianity and paganism, because Christianity was now growing very strong, and to keep the empire united. But let's go back to Alexandria. The infiltrators included a man called Origen. Now, Origen looked at the Bible. He said, I'm going to change some of this to agree with my own teaching. Now, he pretended to be a Christian. He had been baptized into the Christian church. He had graduated from a Christian college. He now became a teacher in that college. And he thought he was a bit wiser than the Bible writers, and so he began chopping out passages of the Bible that didn't suit him.
Ah, is that where the Alexandrian texts then of the Bible came from, huh?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, I've always wondered. Go right ahead.
And he allegorized other Bible events that he wanted not to be taken literally. And, of course, this double-pronged approach of cutting out bits and allegorizing other bits suited both the pagan and the false Christian.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
I think that is fascinating, you know, because, of course, there were a couple of Cambridge scholars many years later who then, of course, tried to incorporate the Alexandrian text into modern-day Christianity and use that to undermine it. It was Hort, I forgot the two people, but they...
Yeah, Westcott and Hort.
Westcott and Hort, right. Go right ahead.
And that's a fascinating story too, Dr. Steen, if we have time for it.
I don't think we'll get to Westcott and Hort, but that will be something else for our listeners, because basically, of course, they wrote the standard dictionary used to translate Greek into English, and this is what all of our ministers use. They use Westcott and Hort's dictionary, and they've gotten for 100 years. All of the wrong information. Both of these people were deeply involved in the occult. And, of course, they had a profound impact on modern-day Christianity. But you go right ahead. So we're talking about the Alexandrian text of the Bible.
That's right, yes. Now, these guys what had happened was that when the Christians fled from Jerusalem... Many of them, well, actually, they'd all, first of all, gone to a little town called Pella on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and then they made their way up northward into Syria to a town called Antioch. And in Antioch, which is mentioned in the Bible, the Christians were first called Christians in Antioch. In Antioch, they set up a college to preserve and to copy as many copies of the scriptures as they could. And Antioch became a missionary center for the whole world. Now, from Antioch, missionaries were sent down to Egypt. And Alexandria, being a center of pagan philosophy, the Christian church worked very hard there to win people to the Lord. And they succeeded quite well. But, of course, the pagans were very upset by this. So after persecution failed, they said, well, the most successful thing will be to neutralize this Christian movement. So we've got to infiltrate it and pretend that we're joining it. And then when we get into positions of power, we will teach our beliefs. And that will mean the Christian religion will disappear.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, because Jonathan was just saying that after the siege of Jerusalem, why many of the Christians, of course, were able to escape, and then, of course, they migrated north, suddenly up to Antioch, where they set up their missionary center and began sending their disciples out to spread the gospel. And, of course, some of them went to Alexandria, but the people in Alexandria, of course, wanted to destroy Christianity, and when they realized they couldn't destroy it, then they set out to infiltrate it and change the structure. And I think that's where the Alexandrian text came from. That today have replaced the traditional text of the Bible, at least in many of our major universities and seminaries. But go right ahead.
Yeah. Now, then, of course, we move across to Rome, the capital of the empire. Rome and Alexandria worked in very nicely together, because while Alexandria was the center of pagan philosophy, Rome was the center of the empire, and it was the center of pagan sun worship. And the two, of course, were one and the same religion. And in the city of Rome, of course, persecution became very intense also. And we remember about Nero blaming the Christians for the burning of Rome, and we've heard of the Christian catacombs. I've been down underground under the city of Rome, and I've walked through the catacombs where they lived and worshipped and buried their dead and hid away from persecution. And for a long time, persecution continued in Rome. Ultimately, Christianity was becoming so strong, however, because the blood of the martyrs only sowed seed, and many more Christians would spring up. When they saw that this is a powerful movement and nothing can stop it, it grew and it grew, and it threatened paganism. And if the message of Jesus Christ was true, then it meant that the pagan altars of Rome would disappear, and that could not be allowed to happen. And so once again, they followed the example of Alexandria and other places, and they said, all right, we've got to infiltrate. And we'll not only infiltrate here in Rome, but we'll infiltrate everywhere that we have our influence. But Rome became the center. And it wasn't too much longer before the church in Rome, persecution stopped. A Roman emperor declared that Christianity could be accepted as one of the religions of the empire, and that was a political ploy because half the empire was now Christian and half the empire was pagan. And he, being a good politician, could not have such a divided empire. He wanted one religion only in the empire, and that would be an amalgamation of the two. So he looked around for a document that could unite both of them. And immediately he recognized the Alexandrian manuscript that had been fiddled by Origen and said, this will suit my purpose. Here is a Bible that both Christians and pagans can be united upon. And so Constantine's friend Eusebius was asked to edit the Origen's Bible, and Constantine had 50 copies made. And this became the basis of the Bible that was eventually adopted by the church in Rome. Now, you mentioned the Alexandrian manuscripts. That's true. Now, we believe we know three of these. There are at least three surviving manuscripts of the 50 that Constantine had Eusebius make. One is called the Sinaiticus, and it's interesting that that was found in a Catholic monastery down in Sinai, and the Vaticanus was found in the Vatican, and both these manuscripts had been lost for several hundred years, but at a very crucial time for church history, they were brought out as weapons against the true Bible manuscripts. There's evidence that these manuscripts are survivors of the type ordered by Constantine. Now, Constantine thought that was a good move, and for his political ploy it was, but there was one problem. There were too many wide-awake Christians scattered all over the empire and outside the empire who couldn't help noticing that Origen's Bible, adopted by Constantine, this revised Bible, compared unfavorably with the original pure Bible that had been preserved. And there was now a battle of the Bible. Now, Rome occupied the strategic gateway to Asia at Constantinople, and these uncorrupted Bibles, along with the Greek and the Eastern literature, were sealed off. It was decided to seal off the East from the West so the people in the West could be given the corrupted Bibles and the church in the East could have no type of influence any longer. And as a result of this policy of censorship, most of Europe was plunged into the Dark Ages. And around 400 AD, Jerome gave the church in Rome another acceptably altered Bible of the same type, but it did not gain ready acceptance. Later on, it became known, however, as the Latin Vulgate. Well, let's just see who these chief corruption culprits were. First of all, there was Clemens of Alexandria, who just preceded Origen. He boasted, he was a teacher in the Christian church in Alexandria. He was one of the infiltrators. He said, I will not teach Christianity unless mixed in with pagan philosophy. Then came his pupil, Origen, who allegorized the Bible and cut out bits to suit himself to make it compatible with pagan philosophy. Then came Emperor Constantine, who commissioned the corrupted Bible to be used in Rome. And then came Jerome, who drew on this altered Bible as one of the sources for producing the Latin Vulgate for the church in Rome. So that was the history of that manuscript. Now, when we look at the Vaticanus corruption, these Alexandrian manuscripts have so many changes in them. It's absolutely amazing. I think it's a subject we could go into another time, but I just thought I'd mention that there are thousands of changes, not just a few dozen or a few hundred. There are several thousand changes in these. Incredible. And yet these manuscripts that were corrupted, I've seen people on the internet and elsewhere making claims that you can't believe the New Testament because it's been changed. Constantine and his men changed it. Well, of course, they adopted a changed manuscript, but they had no influence outside their own territory. And as it happens, 99% of the old manuscripts we have today represent the pure, unchanged manuscript. The altered versions only represent 1%, so you can't say the Bible's been changed. 1% was mutilated. 1% of all the manuscripts mutilated. 99% of all the manuscripts remained pure through history, and that's a wonderful story of preservation which I'd love to tell.
And that is that what they call the Textus Receptus?
Yes, that's right. The Textus Receptus, which means it's a traditional text, and which means, really, the text that has been received from the apostles.
Right.
And it's also the majority text.
Now, that is the basis of King James, then?
That's the basis of the King James Bible. The King James Bible is the most faithfully translated Bible that we have in the English language.
Is that better than the Calvin's translation?
Calvin actually is very, very close.
Okay.
There's not much difference. Calvin got his from the Textus Receptus as well. And it's a very good Bible. But I should say, the King James, there's nothing more accurate than it, but it's the most widely distributed, most accurate Bible in our language.
I guess they call that the Geneva Bible, but be that as it may, I mean, basically there is a difference between that, and then they have all these new translations that they keep coming up with in an effort to destroy our faith in the validity of the Scriptures. These people on the other side are so clever, they hate Christianity, and will find any reason to disbelieve it.
That's true.
You go right ahead here.
Okay. So what we have here now is a scripture that has been perverted, and the perversion only represents 1% of manuscripts. The rest of the manuscripts all over the world, now by the time of Constantine, which is about in the middle of the 4th century, there were so many thousands of manuscripts. Constantine could never get his hands on those and recall them and replace them with his corrupted manuscripts. And so the pure manuscripts remained in use all across the world, including in his own territory, by faithful people who had to go bush and hide in the mountains to preserve it, but they did. And we bear in mind the Vaudois people, the Waldenses, the Pyrenees Alps and so on, a marvellous story. If anyone ever can get hold of that book, The History of the Waldenses by Dr. Wiley, it's well worth reading. It'll stiffen your backbone. Anyway, when we look at what was happening in Rome, though, we realize that today people mistake Rome for Christianity and Christianity for Rome. Whenever you think of a religion, you think of one big religion which is so well known and is the richest in the world. And a lot of people mistake that for what Christianity is. Now, there are many churches today which claim to be Christian, but that doesn't make them Christian any more than claiming that a tail of a sheep is a fifth leg. It's no more Christian except by name than what it will teach and how it will act. And so we can't judge Jesus Christ by what many Christian people profess today. We've got to go right back to the Bible, and we've got to live by it if we want to give a witness of what true Christianity is about.
And yet, of course, some Catholics already live by the Bible. In fact, one of the most amazing things was Pope John Paul XXIII and the dramatic changes he brought to Catholic Church. But one of the most important things he did was to give Catholics the ability to read the Scriptures. I mean, and that suddenly allowed them to get to the Bible and really find out what Christianity was about, not simply go to church and hear the sermons in Latin which they couldn't understand. So whatever reason Pope John Paul XXIII did what he did, whether he meant it for good or evil, I don't know, but certainly God used it for good.
Well, yes, and so my dear wife grew up in that religion, and she's the most wonderful woman in the world. So the fact is, God has His people everywhere, and when a system gets taken over by the enemy, you can't blame the ordinary people, and many of them are as good as all of us. But we're talking here about a fierce battle, a fierce cosmic war that's going on, and the agencies which are being used in this war. Now, I mentioned the World Entities. I spent quite a lot of time in Italy, and I've been in the Vatican. I've studied through the Vatican. I've been underground into some of the churches. I have gone through the valleys of the persecuted World Entities who kept the light of flame alive for hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, the missionaries from Antioch first came across to Italy, and many of the dear Italian people became very strong Bible believers, and that's why they were persecuted. And a number of them, when the church in the capital city adopted paganism, they realized that they must get out, and so they fled up into the northern valleys of between Italy and France, and there they kept the gospel light aflame right through the Dark Ages. Wonderful people. Thousands of them died and were burnt at the stake. Their Bibles were burnt when they were found, but they, despite that, they fought the good fight and they kept their faith. And that Bible, at the time of the Reformation, was still being used by them. And when the Reformation opened up access to the East, Church of the East outside the old Roman Empire territories, and they brought manuscripts from the East, Bible manuscripts that had been copied at Antioch and used in places as far away as India. When they compared the Eastern manuscripts with the Waldensian Western manuscripts hidden in those valleys of northern Italy, they found that they were virtually identical. And as you suggested, Dr. Stan, these became the basis of what we today call the King James Bible.
Okay, well, so that gives us the background, and then we've got maybe about 6 minutes more, so you go right ahead.
Okay. Now, one of the great champions of the Reformation, which was a return to the Bible, was because the Bible was burnt by the ruling church for hundreds of years. In fact, history shows, and unfortunately, these books are being borrowed out from libraries and never returned. And whether this is a deliberate plan, I don't know, but it's a pattern worldwide that the history books which reveal what went on in the Dark Ages are disappearing from our public libraries everywhere. When the Reformation struck, Martin Luther, one of the greatest champions of history, of God's Word, rose up in Germany. And his revelations were followed by those of Huss and Calvin and Wesley and others. It shook the established church to its knees, because the established church was suppressing the Bible and burning the Bible. And so there had to be a counterattack, and an organization was raised up. I don't know if I should mention its name, but it's a well-known name beginning with J. And this organization was raised up deliberately to destroy the Protestant Reformation. And one of the first things they did was to do what they had done in the city of Rome, in the city of Alexandria earlier, and that was to infiltrate the Lutheran seminaries and the Church of England seminaries, and infiltrate all the seminaries they could and become members of those churches, so that they could rise to positions of power and start attacking the Bible in the minds of the people. And so what we have arising in Germany became the first target. The target was to get rid of the Reformation. They had to destroy the Bible, because the Bible was the basis of the, was the power behind the Reformation.
You know, I think it's so interesting today. We hear, well, my goodness, there's this group of Methodist ministers, and they all say, well, oh, we all believe it's important to be able to ordain homosexuals and women to be ministers in the Methodist Church, or Lutheran, or, and you say, why would all these ministers, you know, be out advocating things which we know that God believes to be wrong? Well, it's because they have been infiltrated into the churches. They've gone through the seminaries. They certainly have entered the church. They've certainly lived the frugal life of a minister, so they could be there to undermine faith in Christianity today and confuse Christians. And we got an awful lot of confused Christians. But there is, ladies and gentlemen, a conspiracy against God. Certainly, my good friend Colonel Ron Ray had talked to this communist many years ago about their effort to undermine the fabric of our society. He asked him about the church, and David Horowitz, of course, born as a communist, grinned and said that was the easiest thing at all. It was easiest of all the things we had to do. Easiest to infiltrate the churches and infiltrate the seminaries and change the music and the message of the Christian church. And boy, they did a good job of it. But this is a coordinated effort by those who hate God. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Jonathan, we've got 3 minutes. You go right ahead.
Okay. Right, so Germany became the spearhead of the attack, because Germany was the home of the Reformation, the first home. They had to get their revenge on Germany. And this is why from Protestant seminaries in Germany, there came out now new theories about the Bible. One was called textual criticism, the other was called modernism. They're both the same, really. And the teaching of modernism or textual criticism is this, that the Bible cannot be depended upon literally. It has errors in it. It contains contradictions, and that it's not historically true. Some of the events, like the Exodus of Moses and David, King Solomon, these people never existed. And this is now sweeping through many of the right throughout the Protestant world. It started in Germany, and when Britain broke away and joined the Reformation, the infiltration began at Oxford University, which was training the pastors of the Church of England. And the Oxford movement began, and this is where Westcott and Hort came up. They were secretly worshippers of the Virgin Mary, and they were occultists who also had spiritualistic seances with the devil, and they secretly worked for 20 years with a committee to bring out a new Bible that would eventually get rid of the King James Bible. And that was known as the Revised Version of 1888. And that was based upon the corrupted manuscripts from Alexandria that Rome had adopted. And it was then followed with more manuscripts translated, the same manuscripts rather, translated into modern versions. And now today, of course, Rome supports the Bible. While it was previously burnt and attacked, now she's got her own versions out. She's very happy for that, because it helps to water down the Protestant teaching and bring her own in. And Westcott and Hort's translation is the basis of all the modern versions based on the faulty manuscripts.
Well, again, of course, until we go back, of course, to the King James or the Geneva Bible, and that's why they are constantly under attack today. Our guest has been Jonathan Gray. It's been fascinating. I hope we could perhaps even continue this another time. I think there, I mean, certainly you have tied together so many of the loose ends, and I know very well that our listeners out across America are going to benefit from your teaching. I'm personally indebted to you myself. I've learned so much from listening to you and watching your DVDs. Thank you so much for being with us. Can we call on you again to continue this discussion?
Oh, certainly, Dr. Stan, and God bless you too.
And God bless. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoy Jonathan Gray. Remember, you can go to his website. Just go to your search engine, type in Jonathan Gray or BeforeUs.com. BeforeUs.com. Fascinating material. And, of course, basically, of course, there is a conspiracy against God, and Jonathan traces this from the ancient times. And certainly we'll try to make up a four tape set on the previous 2 hours and this 2 hours. And then we hope we can get him on again, because you have to understand this conspiracy which exists today. That we will do anything at all to destroy the Christian foundation of our nation, the Christian foundation of Christianity. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there across America listening to our discussion, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to continue doing what we're doing, you know, night after night, and certainly with almost 60 outlets, actually approaching 65 outlets every single week. We're reaching more people than ever before, but quite frankly, we need your help. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, if you agree that we are involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational battlefield, then give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Now, of course, we do have a great deal of information on so many of these subjects that we've talked about here. We certainly carry Jonathan's excellent book, going into the background, certainly, of what's going on today. We actually, of course, will be putting together a Fort CD set based upon the previous 2 hours with Jonathan and this 2 hours. If you want to understand how America financed Adolf Hitler, both before and during the Second World War, you want to get my DVD, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, my interview with Professor Sutton, and then, of course, his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, John Loftus's book, America's Nazi Secret, and Charles Higham, certainly Trading with the Enemy. And you'll come to realize that certainly it was actually both before and during World War II that American corporations, Americans, were building the weapons for Adolf Hitler, because he never could have done this on his own. He didn't have the money, but we were providing the money. We were providing the factories. We were providing the weapons that were used to kill American soldiers, just as today. We are inciting a great war in the Middle East, and there's going to be a terrible war coming in the Middle East. In fact, Richard Perle, at the latest Bilderberger meeting, talked about the necessity of a great war in the Middle East. And this is the latest reports coming out. The people who were there at the Bilderberger meetings and the Bilderbergers talked about the war we're going to have. So once you understand that, you begin making preparations for the very difficult times that lay ahead. Certainly the Russians are preparing for a nuclear war. The Swiss are preparing for a nuclear war. And in Sweden and in Singapore and South Korea, they're building their underground shelters. But we have no underground shelters here today for the people. They do for the elite. They have them on the West Coast in Denver. They have them on the East Coast. But not for the American people. You're going to have to start thinking about looking after yourself and your family. And, of course, we have a great deal of information on that from Joel Skousen in his Strategic Relocation, in his book on the secure home and the secure rooms. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. We hope you'll join the Radio Liberty family. You'll tell others. And then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection.